supplies from Pancho and sell them to the prospectors. We can sell supplies to the miners, too.
Most of the mining teams work for Humphreys, Fuchs replied darkly, or Astro.
But they still need supplies, Amanda insisted. Even if they get their equipment from the corporations, they'll still need personal items. Soap, entertainment videos, clothing. Fuchs's face was set in a grimace. I don't think you would want to handle the kinds of entertainment videos these prospectors buy. Undaunted, Amanda said, Lars, we could compete against Humphreys Space Systems while you're directing the habitat construction. Compete against Humphreys? Fuchs rolled the idea on his tongue, testing it. Then he broke into a rare grin. It made his broad, normally dour face light up. Compete against Humphreys, he repeated. Yes, yes, we can do that. Amanda saw the irony in it, although the others didn't. The daughter of a small shopkeeper in Birmingham, she had grown up hating her middle-class background and the lower-class workers her father sold to. The boys were rowdy and lewd at best, and they could just as easily become dangerously violent. The girls were viciously catty. Amanda discovered early that being stunningly beautiful was both an asset and a liability. She was noticed wherever she went. All she had to do was smile and breathe. The trick was, once noticed, to make people see beyond her physical presence, to recognize the highly intelligent person inside that tempting flesh. While still a teenager, she learned how to use her good looks to get boys to do what she wanted, while using her sharp intellect to keep one jump ahead of them. She escaped her father's home and fled to London, took lessons to learn to speak with a polished accent, and, to her complete astonishment, found that she had the brains and skill to be a first-rate astronaut. She was hired by Astro Manufacturing Corporation to fly missions between Earth and the Moon. With her breathless looks and seeming naivety, almost everyone assumed she had slept her way to the top of her profession. Yet the truth was just the opposite. Amanda had to work hard to fend off the men and women who wanted to bed her. It was at Cellini that she had met Martin Humphreys. He had been her gravest danger. He wanted Amanda, and he had the power to take what he wanted. Amanda had married Lars Fuchs in part to get away from Humphreys, and Lars knew it. Now, here on the fringe of humankind's expansion through the solar system, she was about to become a shopkeeper herself. How father would howl at that, she thought. The father's revenge. The child becomes just like the parent in the end. Humphreys won't like competition, Cardenas pointed out.
Good,
exclaimed Fuchs. Shaken out of her reverie, Amanda said, Competition will be good for the prospectors, though, and the miners, too. It will lower the prices they have to pay for everything. I agree, said Cardenas, but Humphreys won't like it, not one little bit. Fuchs laughed aloud.
Good, he repeated.
Two years later.
As soon as he stepped out onto the surface of Ceres, Fuchs realized that this was the first time he'd been in a spacesuit in months. The suit still smelled new. He'd only used it once or twice. Mein Gott, he said to himself, I've become a bourgeois. The suit didn't fit all that well either. The arms and legs were a trifle too long to be comfortable. His first venture into space had been aboard Star Power One's ill-fated maiden voyage 5 years earlier. He'd been a graduate student then, heading for a doctorate in planetary geochemistry. He never returned to school. Instead, he married Amanda and became a rock rat, a prospector seeking his fortune among the asteroids of the belt. For nearly 2 years now, he had abandoned even that to run a supply depot on Ceres and supervise the Habitat project. Helvetia Limited was the name Fuchs had given his fledgling business, incorporating it under the regulations of the International Astronautical Authority. He was Helvetia's president, Amanda its treasurer, and Pancho Lane a vice president who never interfered in the company's operations. She seldom even bothered to visit its headquarters on Ceres. Helvetia bought most of its supplies from Astro Corporation and sold them to the rock rats at the lowest markup Amanda would allow. Humphreys Space Systems ran a competing operation, and Fuchs gleefully kept his prices as low as possible, forcing Humphreys to cut his own prices or be driven off Ceres altogether. The competition was getting to the cutthroat level. It was a race to see who would drive whom out of business. The rock rats obviously preferred dealing with Fuchs to dealing with HSS. To his pleasant surprise, Helvetia Limited prospered, even though Fuchs considered himself a mediocre businessman. He was too quick to extend credit on nothing more than a rock rat's earnest promise to repay once he'd struck it rich. He preferred a handshake to the small print of a contract. Amanda constantly questioned his judgment, but enough of those vague promises came through to make Helvetia profitable. "They're getting rich," Fuchs realized happily as his bank account at Cellini fattened. "Despite all of Humphrey's tricks, we are getting rather wealthy." Now, gazing around the bleak, battered surface of Ceres, he realized all over again how lonely and desolate this place was, how far from civilization. The sky was filled with stars, such a teeming profusion of them that the old familiar constellations were lost in their abundance. There was no friendly old moon or blue-glowing earth hanging nearby. Even the sun looked small and weak, dwarfed by distance. A strange, alien sky, stark and pitiless. Ceres's surface was broodingly dark, cold, pitted by thousands of craterlets, rough and uneven, boulders and smaller rocks scattered around everywhere. The horizon was so close it looked as if he were standing on a tiny platform rather than a solid body. For a giddy instant, Fuchs felt that if he didn't hang on, he'd fall up, off this worldlet, into the wild wilderness of stars. Almost distraught, he caught sight of the unfinished habitat rising above the naked horizon, glittering even in the weak sunlight. It steadied him. It might be a ramshackle collection of old, used, and stripped-down spacecraft, but it was the handiwork of human beings out here in this vast, dark emptiness. A gleam of light flashed briefly. He knew it was the little shuttlecraft bringing Pancho and Ripley back to the asteroid's surface. Fuchs waited by the squat structure of the airlock that led down into the living sections below ground. The shuttle disappeared past the horizon, but in a few minutes it came up over the other side, close enough to see its insect-thin legs and bulbous canopy of its crew module. Pancho had insisted on flying the bird herself, flexing her old astronaut muscles. Now she brought it in to a smooth landing on the scoured ground about 100 meters from the airlock. As the two spacesuited figures climbed down from the shuttle, Fuchs easily recognized Pancho Lane's long, stringy figure, even in her helmet and suit. This was the first time in nearly a year that Pancho had come to Ceres, doubling up on her roles of Astro board member and Helvetia vice president. Tapping on the communications keyboard on his left wrist, Fuchs heard her talking with Ripley, the engineer in charge of the construction project. "What you really need is a new set of welding lasers," she was saying, "instead of those clunkers you're working with." Rather than trying to walk in the low-gravity shuffle that was necessary on Ceres, Fuchs took the jetpack control box into his gloved hand and barely squeezed it, feather light. As usual, he overdid the thrust and sailed over the heads of Pancho and the engineer, nearly ramming into the shuttlecraft. His boots kicked up a cloud of dark dust as he touched down on the surface. "Lord, Lars, when are you going to learn how to fly one of those rigs?" Pancho teased. Inside his helmet, Fuchs grinned with embarrassment. "I'm out of practice," he admitted, sliding his feet across the surface toward them, raising still more dust. The ground felt gritty, pebbly, even through his thick-soled boots. "You never were in practice, buddy." He changed the subject by asking the engineer, "So, Mr. Ripley, will your crew be able to assemble the latest additions on schedule?"
"Believe it or not," Ripley replied archly, "they will."
Niles Ripley was an American of Nigerian heritage, an engineer with degrees from Lehigh and Penn, an amateur jazz trumpet player who had acquired the nickname Ripper from his headlong improvisations. The sobriquet sometimes caused problems for the mild-mannered engineer, especially in bars with belligerent drunks. The Ripper generally smiled and talked his way out of confrontations. He had no intention of letting some muscle-bound oaf damage his horn-playing lip.
"Your schedule will be met," Ripley went on. Then he added, "despite its lack of flexibility."
Fuchs jabbed back, "Then your crew will earn its bonus, despite their complaints about the schedule." Pancho interrupted their banter.
"I've been telling old Ripper here that you'd get this job done a lot faster with a better set of welding lasers."
"We can't afford them," Fuchs said. "We are on very tight budget restraints."
"Astro could lease you the lasers. Really easy terms."
Fuchs made an audible sigh.
"I wish that you had thought of that 2 years ago, when we started this operation."
2 years ago, the best lasers we had were big and inefficient. Our lab boys just came up with these new